Paul went around to the back of the temple, and there was an enormous crowd of people listening to men tell stories. There were those coming throughout the day and leaving throughout the day into nighttime. Then they broke off into groups, and in hundreds of homes all over the city, they ate together, and the next day were out looking for work. You could not be impressed. Nonetheless, Paul listened to the stories. Peter was speaking about some of his first impressions of John the Baptist, his impressions of Jesus, quoting things that John said that brought the entire congregation of people to laughter. Things that were funny to them that he did not understand. Songs with words in it that he could not grasp. And stories of the covenant with Israel, Abraham, Moses, that he had never heard before. And some of it caused him a certain amount of uneasiness. Between that and watching them go through the streets, singing, laughing, far too much fun, joy, exuberance than for those who really cared and carried the burden of obeying the law every day. They were a people simply too free. It would certainly lead to sin. But this was only the beginning. There was a synagogue in Jerusalem. His father had helped pay for it, along with other Greeks who were of the diaspora, that is, Hellenic Jews, those whose native tongue was Greek. And there his father had sent money, along with others, to the building of one synagogue in the city of Jerusalem, where the Greek-speaking people could come and have a gathering. That was on Saturday. But for the rest of the week, there were pilgrims coming in. The synagogue was being used for all sorts of things. And then, over the years, it had turned into a place, when the synagogue was in no use whatsoever for any other purpose, to debate. This was not Greek debating. This was Hebrew debating. This was question and answer, and that was all. But the questions could grow quite long, and the answers could grow quite long also. And it was at this time that Paul became very disturbed at what the use of the synagogue and many other things. Those people behind the temple, he did not consider them to be devout Hebrews. They were chasing some false apostle. And yet, the property of the temple grounds was being used by them. And here, a synagogue in which these followers of the way would come in and give their testimony of what had happened to them. They would be asked questions. They were all being treated with a certain amount of reference or deference. And there was going to be something else that happened one day also. We heard news. The year now is the year 36 exactly 10 years since John had been speaking in the wilderness. We heard that the emperor was very ill. This is always disturbing to Jewish people, for they, after all, live in cities from Babylon, perhaps as far over as India, and then westward. There are perhaps even some of them there living among the Franks and their Germanics. There's even rumor that one or two of them live among the Picts in the land of Britannica. But most of them, scattered around any and every place where goods are bought and sold, for it was mostly the Jews and some Greeks who were the merchants, the buyers and the sellers, because they were the only people in the entire empire who could truly be trusted, despite the fact they were always suspected of something terrible. And here was a emperor who was dying, who had been more or less neutral toward the Jewish people, except exactly 3 years ago in the year 33, when he had ordered out all Jews from Jerusalem. But it had been of little effect after the first initial decree was obeyed, and by 36, the Jews were back in the city. And now, with an emperor dying, they felt safe. But who would take his place? No one knew for certain, but it seemed to have been the son of Germanicus, who had been the son of Augustus Caesar, an adopted son. Germanicus had been very popular among all the people of the empire, but had died mysteriously out on the frontier, and not without great suspicion as to the peculiarities of his death, as well as the fact that just 3 days before he died, with all evidence being some kind of poison, an envoy from Tiberius himself had made a great journey out there to the frontier. A few days later, Germanicus had mysteriously died. And only recently, two of his son's brothers, one of them had died. The only person in the bloodline of Augustus Caesar with the largest claim to the throne was a 24-year-old boy of whom no one knew anything. The only thing that was known about him was he was peculiar, and that he had been in Capri for years, being raised there by no one in particular, and had watched so many of his own family tree banished, one deliberately starving themselves to death, another banished, another one mysteriously dying, another one put in a room and never allowed to sleep and to never leave the bed they were in, and yet in some way managed to commit suicide. All this in the reign of Tiberius. The emperor was ill. Somewhere in the next 2 years, he would probably die. And it was those 2 years before his death that a growing hatred grew up in the life of Paul of Tarsus, toward these people who were called the followers of the way. And Paul had learned the names of some of the so-called apostles and some men there who were those who served food to the thousands and growing thousands, who all put their food, their income, their property and everything together in order to take care of not only those who were local, but the thousands who had come there for the Passover, the Pentecost, and who had decided to be baptized and to stay in the city of Jerusalem. All this were stories common to Paul. He had heard of the arrest of John and Peter. He had heard how they had been beaten and released and gone, went back preaching again. He was disgusted with them, that all 12 of the men had been arrested, and that his teacher, whom he had so sacredly believed in, had actually intervened for these people, giving illustrations of other false messiahs who had come and gone and were scattered and their followers disappeared. Paul was angry, but nothing so incensed him as was the man who came into the synagogue to speak and to debate. He was an ordinary man who wore ordinary street clothes, hardly identifying himself as being Jewish, very much a foreigner who could speak Hebrew broken, could understand Aramaic, but spoke in perfect Greek. And soon it was that men were debating him because he was the one that no one could win a debate with. And Paul made trips there again and again and again, and any time he heard that there might be a Stephen who would come there, he came even more regularly in hopes that Stephen would be there. He watched, he heard the arguments, he became familiar with them and the words that Stephen would say. And one day, Paul challenged him to a debate. He was ready. He was more brilliant than the others, more zealous for the truth than the others, pulling all the resources that he had had from his youth, from his training in the synagogue in Tarsus, and now all that he had learned from Gamaliel, and all that was in his own mind. He challenged Stephen to a debate, believing he knew enough of what Stephen had to say that he would certainly trounce him. And so Paul took particularly careful words to choose and topics to discuss, which he believed would be unfamiliar to Stephen. And Stephen returned with more than Paul could have ever believed one man could know. It was not that he knew the scriptures so much as there was something else going for him. It was an illumination within him of a deeper understanding than any had ever seen or known in reading the scripture. It even crossed his mind, maybe I should invite Gamaliel to come in here and debate with Stephen. But no, Gamaliel did not debate anyone. He simply taught the Torah. Over and again, over and over again, until almost every Jew in that city who could speak Greek had come there to watch the debates and had had a growing sense of hatred toward him. Until finally someone said, let's kill him. And it all immediately flashed on me. We had killed so many prophets. We had killed so many men whom we feared, and yet were the heroes of our faith today. Paul was reluctant. He did not like the discussions. Little by little, he was drawn into it. But this question came again and again. We have no legal right to kill this man. We certainly have no right to kill him without a hearing or a trial. He is Jewish. We break every law in the Torah. Only it was met with such penetrating logic. But a man who denies the Torah, should he not die? A man who is teaching things concerning the law of Moses that we have never heard, things that have never been said, things that have never been thought nor taught, should he not die? This sect of Israel had to end. And then a very wise statement was made. The emperor is dying. He will die somewhere on Capri. He will be taken to the city, declared Rome, and declared a god. And then when the new man is chosen to take his place, at that time, all of the governors, all 100 of them, will make their way to Rome at the same time, coming on the ships, the endless ships the Romans had under their control. For Rome was not only a great physical ground, a military power, but an incredibly great naval power. Those people would be taken to Rome immediately, and so would their associates and assistants, and all of them would kiss the ring, bow before the new emperor, and kiss his ring, and verbally announced his total, absolute, unqualified allegiance, and swear an oath to obey any and all orders given by the new emperor. Abide. Bide your time. The man will die. And this city will be left alone, and Caesarea by the sea will have no procurator, no governor. And so the plot was finished. It was a matter now of time. So everyone heard of the death of Tiberius. The details of the death would not be well known for a while. One of the people who made his way to Rome to kiss the ring of the new emperor was himself being called home, and he would never be heard from again. His name was Pontius Pilate, who had just recently slain an entire group of pilgrims, all Samaritans, going up to the sacred hill of Ebal because there was a rumor that the two tablets of Moses had been discovered and they were all following a prophet there. Pilate, in turn, had thought it was some sort of rebellion. He had heard that it was being led by men who had decided to break away from the empire. He and his soldiers came, found the people, and drove them into a fenced barricade and slaughtered every man, woman, and child. And Pilate had already been called back to Rome. A new man would come soon, and he would be coming back when everyone else came back from Rome. And they waited. Who was the new emperor? He's a 25-year-old boy with a nickname. His name was Little Boots. His name was Gaius. The large number of other names that came after it. There were stories about him that he looked very much like Germanicus, and that he might have even looked like, in some ways, Augustus Caesar. There were also some other rumors that he enjoyed torturing little animals, that he was a young man given over to connivings and plots. But he had always stayed clear of any insinuations of anything but total loyalty to Tiberius. What had happened that day was Tiberius was dead and pronounced dead. And the young man reached over and seized his ring and slipped it onto his own hand, declaring himself emperor. And about that moment, Tiberius stood up, sat up, and said, "I am hungry." Macro, the prefect, who had taken the place of Sergianus, with everyone else horrified, calmly walked over, took a pillow, and suffocated Tiberius to death. And 1 month later, by the way, that was on March the 16th of the year 37 A.D., March 16th. 37 A.D. 1 month later, everyone else in leadership throughout the entire Roman Empire was on their way to Rome to participate in the choosing of the new emperor, Gaius Caligulus. And what was known of him would never have been believed if anyone knew it anyway. And it was at this time Stephen was debating, and he mentioned the Lord Jesus Christ and the resurrection. They grabbed him sitting. He was pulled out through the streets, and there was a pit nearby exactly 11 feet deep. And there he was stoned. And the men took off their garments, symbolism of a dirty job to be done, but it must be done. But each man took his coat off and handed it to Paul of Tarsus while he stood near the abyss and watched Stephen die. Hatred that flowed as great as it could in that man's heart. But still, some of the things that he said haunted him for the months that followed, which even brought him to greater rage. It was at this moment that the high priest himself sent a messenger to Paul to come immediately to the high priest. We'll begin there next time. This is number 5. The high priest said something very simple to say, we will destroy the gatherings of the followers of the way. A plan had already been set in motion, but because of his known zeal, the high priest of the Sanhedrin had chosen Paul to do some very special things, and they were very special indeed. To all the houses where they were known to be meetings, Paul was to enter, and with the rites of the high priest and the Sanhedrin, especially made up not of the Pharisees but the Sadducees, to move into every home, jail those people, and put them on trial. They were to be, this was to be done in Jerusalem, and especially not only in Jerusalem, but in the immediate area around. And so the jails were filled to running over until there were parts of the temple, homemade jails, and still the numbers grew, home after home, young women, men, and then began the trials. They were swift. You had choices of being beaten, or fleeing, or incarcerated for a long period of time. It is difficult for us to understand this until we understand a very simple thing. The high priest and the Sadducees owned almost every house in Jerusalem. They were rented to others. There were exceptions. One of them was the home of a man we will meet soon whose name was Barnabas, a man who perhaps was of great wealth. Most of the city. The real estate belonged to the Sadducees and the Sanhedrin. Invested, vested interest in seeing the city prosper and for peace to reign so that nothing be disturbed, placate everyone at any cost. Instead of including crucifying a troublemaker. Real estate and money was at the heart of all of this. And so the weeks came into months. The followers of the way poured out of the city of Jerusalem to over 100 towns. And Paul of Tarsus, while still an unbeliever, had become the most effective church planter in the first 7 years of the church. Speaking of the Great Commission, the apostles had not obeyed it. They had not even left Jerusalem, except to go out to a few towns. But now, the apostles in hiding were going out to town after town to help bring forth approval of all the churches being born spontaneously in Judea and Galilee, all because of Paul of Tarsus. Now the high priest called Paul in one day and said, one of the largest concentrations of those who are followers of the way are in the city Damascus. Damascus was on a straight route north from Jerusalem along something that had been called the Royal Road and the King's Highway. It had been built by the Persians hundreds of years ago. The young and zealous man, now 29 years old in the year 37, set out for Damascus with warrants for the rest of any followers of the way who might be meeting in the synagogue there. And a man who would have lived and died in obscurity is about to walk upon the pages of history. Even the book of Acts divides here from the day of Pentecost until this day, right here. The story has been with the apostles in Jerusalem and the Jews. Now our young man is on his way, and he is breathing threats. And not only is he breathing threats, but he is hearing the words of a man he watched die from dozens, perhaps hundreds, of small rocks and stones. A man who said, "I see Jesus standing at the right hand of God the Father." And he fell asleep. And this was not acceptable. This is not acceptable to this young man who would have Jesus standing before God. While this is going on, some very devout men in Jerusalem take the body of Stephen very quietly and bury it with great tears and with great emotion. He walks from Jerusalem to Damascus. He passes Bethsaida. He passes Capernaum. Comes out into the desert areas. It is the middle of the year 37. Still breathing threats, anger and rage, and a company of people with him, some men who are accompanying him to Damascus, perhaps to bring their prisoners back. Paul is clutching a signed arrest warrant from the high priest. Exactly what happened after that remains in the mystery, the annals of mystery. Suddenly, on the road, due north, probably in the early evening, there is a blinding light. Paul hears a name, a voice. It's distinct to him. To the others who have fallen on their faces, all they hear are words. they cannot understand. The light. It is the light that makes this unique. This cannot be Satan, it cannot be the devil, it cannot be demons. Nothing is so bright. Paul puts his hand in front of his face. He tries to find some place where it is not light. He looks again at the light, hoping that he would be able to see some portion of his body, and he realizes the light is not shining on him. The light is going straight through him. It is as though his hands were not there. The light is not around him. It's penetrating him. It's going past his arms, past his body, his face, and passing all the way through him. Paul is standing in a storm of blinding light that is not hindered by dimension whatsoever. And so he knows one thing. Whatever is happening to him and whoever this is, he's his new Lord. And stunned by all of this, he cries out instinctively, because there's somebody there, even though that person is nothing but solid, blinding, even killing light. His eyes are not looking at light. Light is going straight through him. And he cries, "Who are you, Lord?" And the great revelation of Christ and his church begins. "I'm Jesus, whom you're persecuting." And Jesus had died on a cross. He had been dead now for 7 years. He had never met him, never heard him, and certainly had never persecuted him. But that was not the opinion of God. "You are persecuting me." Understand the mind of God. God the Son does not distinguish himself from those who have believed upon him. And the man who is stark blind has nothing he can do but wonder which direction an utterly, totally blind human being is. The Lord moves away, or had he moved inside? The others began asking questions, telling what had happened to them. But by looking in the very face of Paul, they knew he was utterly blind. And so they led him by the hand, and they took him in pity to a room. And now we're looking at a very involved and busy God here. And the Lord speaks to Ananias. Very common name in that day. It just so happens it's one of the names of one of the two high priests who live at this time. Ananias, I want to give you the address of the one who you are to go and see. Go see Paul. He answers, Lord, this man has a reputation. And the Lord speaks to Ananias, and he speaks to Paul also. Go find him, go see him, go talk to him, put your hands on him. He is my servant now, and he will suffer greatly for my sake. Paul, you will follow me from now on. Paul, you're going to suffer for my sake. Do you understand? You are going to suffer for my sake. And then he says something else to him. Paul, I'm going to have you work. Saul could not be a more broken man and open to anything, and he knows that everything he ever said or believed was wrong. He is a humiliated man. His pride is broken. He is so ignorant. And then the Lord says, I'm going to send you. I'm going to send you to the Gentiles. For one moment, Paul is absolutely horrified. He's never touched one of those things. And he'd been persecuting the Jews. And he's going to the Gentiles. And he's been a strict obeyer of the law and cleanliness. And he's going to those unclean people. And he begins to laugh. What a Lord and what a statement. You're taking the most religious man alive, a Jew's Jew, a Pharisee of Pharisees, every jot, dot, and tittle, and you're going to send me to the unclean. Paul, realize he lives in a new world now. He begins to laugh, and the thought overwhelms him, and he begins to cry. And then he cries at his laughter. Then he laughs at his crying. And he falls back and just laughs and cries and cries and laughs. I'm going to the Gentiles. I'm going to the Gentiles? I going to the Gentiles? An uproarious laugh. A heart broken. A man shattered. A broken vessel. Crying convulsively. And after he settles down, someone comes to the door, knocks on the door, and says, Saul? And he remembers the words of the Lord, and Saul, why are you persecuting me? And he remembers, I am Jesus, whom you're persecuting. And now there's no why. The why is gone. I'm not persecuting them anymore. Ananias comes in. Paul. Saul. Yes. the Lord has sent me to you. He told me to pray for you. Saul grabs Ananias' hand, feels his face, draws him up close to him. Did you say God, the Lord, sent you to me? Yes. I have been persecuting Jesus. Ananias is stunned. I am now a believer in Jesus the Christ. And Ananias lays hands on Paul's and prays for him, and to Saul's astonishment, the something falls out of his eyes and under his eyelids is like scales, and he can see, and oh, can he see. He is baptized by the body of believers in Damascus, the very ones he was about to haul back to Jerusalem. And they laugh, and they cry, and they hug. And then he remembers, Stephen, and I have something to say. I want to go to the nearest synagogue as fast as I can. And he does. He asks for time to speak, for he has a Pharisee's garment on, and such a man would always be asked to speak. He stands and begins to go over the message. Stephen, which is throbbing within his brain, his heart, his soul, his being. And he tells them he was the one, the people present, who was, I was the persecutor. He gives his entire Damascus Road experience. And they cut him short, indignant, angry, outraged, for these are people who have been rejoicing at the death of the church and the end of the way. And the men grab him and push him over to a doorway. And there his hands are wrapped around what looks like a hook on the facing of the doorpost. His hands are tied. The Christians, the believers, protest. He says no. He screams no. Let it be, with these words ringing in his ears, you must suffer for me. Lord, let me bear the whip marks of you. Lord, let me